Welcome back to this week's Fear or Favour. Nizir, how's your week been?
It's been brilliant, you know. I've been doing the audiobook version of my next book. So I spent 2 days in the studio, 16 hours of it, at the end of which I was fed up with my voice. So I feel for our listeners. I know what it feels like. And and also, this is actually really quite touching. I was in Tesco's and I was sitting there waiting for something to be delivered to me. And some woman walks by and she goes, "Your podcasts are fantastic, you know. They're the thing I want to listen to every week." And I said, whoever she is, and she lives in South Manchester, thank you very much. That made my day.
Brilliant. We're certainly getting some really good feedback. People are fascinated by the subjects we're talking about, but also they like the manner in which we talk about it. And I think that's really important. You know, it's that direct approach.
Yeah.
And it's also practical response.
Yeah, it should be said, and as you know, 10th of September, we're both going to be in Glasgow at CrimeCon delivering this live. We've never done a podcast live, so we'd love to have the audience there to engage with us and get us some insights that we probably haven't had ourselves.
Yeah, we're actually doing it in quite an interesting way, aren't we? Because we're doing it as a live debate through iPads, so
on
mobile phones. So anybody who wants a question, they put it to us, and on the spot, we'll respond.
We hope we can respond.
Great. Well, listen, let's get on with this week's podcast. So quite an eclectic mix of areas that I really want to talk about. Let's start with the HMRC report in relation to burglaries and robberies, thefts in England and Wales. And basically, it's an incredibly damning report by the HMRC, who are saying that currently the charge rates in relation to these crimes is unacceptable and unsustainable. So the problem is that there is such a small percentage of those people that end up being charged, 6.3% of robbery offences, 4.1% of thefts. But it goes deeper than that. And what we've got now is we've got police closing cases almost immediately as they're being reported.
Yeah.
There was reports this week of a case where a Range Rover had been stolen from a driveway. The police closed the case straight away. But actually, the owner of the Range Rover had video footage of the offenders. It's a major problem. It's not something new. It's been going on for some time.
No, but it's got worse and worse and worse. Detection rates have always been poor. I mean, they've been in the lower, less than 10% or thereabouts, but they're at world record lows or UK record lows right now. And, you know, it's quite strange. It says, Andy Crook, who's the Her Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary, used to be Chief Constable of Merseyside, so I know him quite well. And he has to be very, what's the word? Diplomatic. He says, I don't know if there's any link with the fact that we've lost so much experienced police officers and we've got so many detective vacancies up and down the country. Of course there's a bloody link, Andy, and everybody else that knows it. When you lose experience, this is what happens. You can't just replace somebody with 25 years policing experience with somebody that's just come straight out of police academy or police school. It'll take years and years for them to get up to speed. And additionally, I can't think of a force in the land that doesn't have detective vacancies that they can't fill from within their numbers. And so, and also, I think what the report says is, as we know from our own experience, that the first 24 hours after a crime are the critical 24 hours. If you're going to detect anything, they call it the golden day or golden hour, whatever, the forensics that can be done, talking to witnesses while evidence is fresh in their mind. And if you've got nobody to go to the scene to do any of that, well, that's it. You've lost the opportunity.
Therein lies the problem. So I go back to my detective days, in my early detective days, when I was on area as a afternoon DC. You'd come in at 2 o'clock on your shift, and you almost knew with certainty that around 6 o'clock, the burglaries would come in. People had come back from work and the phone calls would come in. And you then had a list of burglaries to go and visit. And on each and every visit, you'd go and see the burglary victim. You'd obviously do an assessment of the house. You'd consider whether or not forensics was appropriate to bring them in. There may be some shoe marks. There may be some cuts of blood on the window where they've broken or something. There's often things that are left fingerprints potentially. But the other crucial thing, of course, is to go and visit neighbours. You know, has one of the neighbours seen a car this afternoon or a van this afternoon? Have they disturbed somebody? So all of those crucial things. Now, you can only do that if you attend the crime scene. And, of course, the massive problem is that officers aren't attending the crime scene.
Yep. Add to that, Mark, the growth of digital evidence. So pretty much everybody will have a, or maybe within sight of a CCTV camera. You may have a Ring or doorbell that recorded something. And they've got to seize that and get that looked at. Time and time again, you'll be able to capture an image of the suspect, but they don't have the capacity definitely to do that. Capability, well, you know, their resources aren't high enough. So absolutely, this 4% figure, or the figure that was articulated today, could clearly and quickly be remedied if you put in a sort of triage type system.
Absolutely.
An A&E type system. You bring in some experienced officers who retired, you know, get them back in, task them to go and do this and get to the scene. And you know, and I know that very often a burglar does one and then there's another house the next night, another house two nights later. So you can really reduce the impact of crime in an area if you focus on catching them for one of these crimes.
Absolutely right. Burglars are creatures of habit. You know, they tend to go to an area, and of course, very often burglars are committing those crimes because of some dependency, maybe alcohol, maybe drug dependency. So you've got a fairly consistent behavior that they're going to do. So if you just targeted it, and we're always looking about, you know, what can we do, or what can be done to make it better? It's all well and good criticizing, but actually the solutions are very simple. The solutions are exactly what you say. Let's target those as being areas of weaknesses, and let's start to build the investigative. The triage system is absolutely right. Let's look to see where we can gain evidence very quickly. Let's make sure that we've got officers out there. And maybe there is maybe burglaries in particular. Burglaries are something where a task force needs to be set up within each individual force, where you literally bring back retired officers. And those retired officers, it is their focus to do that. We've got to do more, because at this present moment in time, the confidence in the police is at an all-time low.
It's next
to zero.
If
they can't solve, and if they can't even be bothered, and it is about being bothered, if they can't even be bothered to do that because they've got such a workload. I mean, let's talk about detective.
The thing about burglary being such a pernicious crime, it's your own home. You've closed your door. It's your safest environment, and you no longer feel safe in your safest environment. Yes. And again, we know from our own experience, a burglar will potentially have, I don't know, hundreds of burglaries. There's a number of things. You could also, you know, the intelligence will tell them who the burglars are. They'll know who it is. You know, they can follow, you know, attach somebody to follow that person and catch them in the act. You know, there's all sorts of things that they can do.
I mean, burglars don't get caught by police on the first time they commit a burglary. You know, I don't know what the statistics are in terms of how soon they are caught after burglaries, but I'm sure they've committed, you know, a good 10, 15.
Hundreds and hundreds. I've dealt with cases where, you know, they plead guilty or they're convicted of one burglary, and then they have a list, which we called, we used to call them TICs, you know, matters taken into consideration. So other burglaries that they accept they were responsible for. And that list could be hundreds of cases long.
I mean, I remember resting and then getting a burglar convicted, and then you'd go and visit them in prison. The old days when you used to go and get TICs, and you go and visit them in prison and talk to them about it. Because the thing is with burglars is that they very much are creatures of habit, and their MO tends to be very much be the same.
Exactly.
So you can link those burglaries together, because of course what we know with the patterns of behavior of human beings is that when they get away with it in one fashion, they will continue
to do it again.
Do it.
I remember one officer took, remember the A to Z? He used to have this, in the day before sat-nav, you'd have this book that would tell you what roads. An officer would go to, when he caught a burglar, would sit down with the A to Z, right?
Yeah,
here's the roads, tell me which ones you did. And you know, they would be, once they've been caught, they want to get it over and done with. They'll tell you what's been happening.
Yeah. And they don't want to come out of the prison and then obviously need to go back in again for other offences.
They'll clear up. You know, they'll clear up hundreds of burglaries potentially. Of course, the other side of burglary is the handling stolen goods, which is another thing we need to be conscious of. And again, the police could do something about. You know, and they have done in the past. You know, so you go to this. You know, the old, what was the old phrase? The fences.
The fence.
I don't know if that we use that phrase anymore. But you know, go to the fences.
You and I in our generation do.
Yeah. Go to the person who's actually buying the stolen good and then selling it on. You know, and before you know it, honestly, they could reduce burglaries like nobody's business. And of course, it has to be said, Yeah, we're in the middle of a heat wave. Burglaries go up in a heat wave.
Yeah.
Guess why? You leave your windows open. You leave your doors open, that kind of stuff, which for opportunist burglars is...
And, of course, people go away. People go away on holidays.
But, yeah, absolutely. Burglaries go up. There's real opportunities for them, unfortunately, but therefore the other side of the coin, real opportunities for the police to catch them in the act.
Yeah. Let's talk very briefly before we move on to the next subject of the shortage of detectives. So I was a detective, and when I applied to become a detective, it was a real honour. It was something that you saw as a climbing up the ladder, as it were. Now, it didn't have any increase in salary, but it had a status. It had a status which was really elevated. The problem with detectives, I've done some work with the Detective Forum. I was at the awards for the Detective Forum. I'm very supportive of them. One of the realities is it is probably one of the worst jobs there is, because you literally have to pick everything up. Your shift, when is you're working an area shift, you might be on a day shift, or you might be on a late, so that's 3 to 11, 2 to 10, whatever it is. Whereas a detective, your shift just carries on. You know, you end up working all kinds of hours.
Well,
your workload is huge. Whereas, of course, as a uniform officer, your workload might be transferable across.
So they need to make the job more attractive.
Yes.
And that clearly starts with remuneration. You know, why, if they're having to fight, and they do fight in tooth and nail to be paid the overtime they've done, never mind paid more for the time they're actually putting into these things. Absolutely. It's not seen as the, on TV, it's the detective that, is the most important figure, carrying out the inquiry and ultimately bringing whoever it is to justice. But the real world, police officers don't see it as attractive enough. So, bring in additional remuneration.
Absolutely.
That seems like a no-brainer, really. Mm. Make it easier for them to be able to claim the overtime for the work that they are doing. It's not as if they're not shirking. They're doing extra time. And also see it as an opportunity for advancement in terms of progression, promotion. So if you spend X number of years as a detective, you almost guarantee that you'll be progressing up the ranks. And that will make this again, why do we seem to have to come up with these no-brainer solutions?
It's so simple.
An obvious problem. And I don't understand it, Mark. You and I ought to be running the police service, because
it's mad.
Those who are don't seem to be able to just think about what the obvious answers are.
As a chief constable, and I appreciate they are juggling budgets, but some of these are very simple, easy fixes, complicated.
And they could make a big difference in a very short space of time. And then before you know it, in 6 months, your local community have so much more confidence in your police force, and they'll be coming to you with their intelligence and information, and you're working together to keep your community safe rather than as it's currently seen. So,
One of those issues we talked about resolving things is, let's just go back quickly to the point of getting retired officers come in to deal with burglaries. You just bring them in as volunteers. It's very simple as that. You pay their mileage, you bring them in as volunteers. And I can tell you there's a considerable amount of retired detectives out there.
Thousands.
Who would want to do that, who would be very...
Literally thousands. I mean, they've done it for 30 years. It's impossible to get out of their blood. They still want to do it.
It's a lifestyle.
They're in and they're doing the job and they're fixing problems that police currently don't have the resources to deal with. Right, okay, well, there you go. I mean, if the Home Secretary's listening, there's your answer.
Yeah. Well, listen, we come up with the great answers every week and people aren't listening to us, but we keep going. So let's talk about the shootings in Sky. So this was obviously something that broke yesterday. And, Sky, beautiful Scottish island, and it is the most beautiful place. And it's probably, obviously, of course, as a result of that, I think the crime rate on Sky is almost zero.
Non-existent.
Yeah, but of course they've had this tragic situation yesterday where a 47-year-old man has died, three people have been injured and are in hospital. And the police have now arrested a 39-year-old man. They've linked all the crimes together. A pretty shocking thing for a community like that.
Devastating. I mean, I remember, I'm old enough to remember Dunblane.
Yes.
Yeah, another Scottish...
And Hungerford. And then, of course, we had Hungerford.
There are places where you would... the least likely, I imagine, you would expect for these horrible things to happen. So I think they shock even more. I hate to say this, but we're somewhat desensitized to murders and killings in urban environments.
Yeah.
We shouldn't be. Every single one matters. But in places like Skye, places where you would never expect this kind of terrible thing to happen. I can't imagine how they'll be coping. I hope they, as most communities do, they come together and support each other, which I'm sure they will, and that they're given support from outside in terms of counselling and trauma support, all of that stuff to rebuild. Because another problem we have in justice is when the circus leaves town, i.e. when a matter has been dealt with and somebody's been arrested, people just forget.
Yeah. But
the people locally don't forget. So we've got to make sure that they're properly supported. Obviously, we don't know enough about the motivations here, but there's no justification for what's happened. I just hope that, as I said, the Scottish Government and others give them as much support as possible.
And I think that's a really strong point you make, because when a critical incident occurs, of course, you have the media, you have the police, you have everybody that rallies around. And of course, the response now for critical incidents and emergencies is very good. But when it ends, when the case has either been closed or someone's arrested, and it's taken years later and nothing's happened, they've not arrested somebody, you still have the families, you still have those people who are left behind. And for them, you know, what people often say to me, yeah, it must get easier over time, you know, when I have an unsolved case or something like that. It doesn't at all. It gets worse.
Time is
no
healer. All these idioms that we all use in our daily life, time is a healer. That one is one I hear all the time. I've been living with victims and for 30-odd years. You have too. Never heals.
And it gets worse because
they have coping mechanisms and they're supported, hopefully, in some way, but it never heals. And
no.
The idea that it does, and we're going to talk later on about historical sexual abuse allegations and others, you know, people live this as if it was today, even if it happened years and years ago.
So our thoughts are with the people of Skye. Let's move on now to something that's very close to both of our work and the things that we feel passionate about, and that is young people. So there is a huge amount of children's homes in Blackpool. We can explore why that is. But what's more worrying is the amount of children who are being sent to Blackpool from hundreds of miles away from where their family is. And of course, one of the huge things of going into a children's home and being removed from your family is that for many, that family is still necessary, but obviously under care or under, you know, close supervision. But to move so far away creates such distance from these young people.
Yeah. Do you know, I thought this had been resolved. When I dealt with the sexual abuse in the early part of last decade, I became aware of this phenomenon where the Northwest was seen as the dumping ground, I hate to use that phrase, for young girls in the main, but also boys, from the southeast of England. So Essex Social Services, Kent Social, you know, they were just sending these, and there was only one reason, it's cheaper.
Yes.
they can justify it in any way. You know, Blackpool is lovely, the seaside. You know,
you buy a house,
it's nothing
cheap
to do with that. It's all to do with its cost.
Yes.
And so we referenced it, we mentioned it, and of course, because of the fact they're hundreds of miles away from home, from people they know and their love and their extended families, all that sort of stuff, they are much more vulnerable.
Mm.
And I love Blackpool. Strange as it may sound, I'm going there shortly, But it has some dark sides.
Yeah, it has huge poverty there. Huge
significant
poverty,
significant drug-related issues, all of those kinds of things. So putting vulnerable children in an environment like that, just because it's cheap, without the right levels of support around them, I'm afraid it's just we're on a hide into nothing, and they're on a hide into nothing.
But it's so simple, isn't it? So you have an area which has got huge poverty, huge dependency on drugs. You only need to walk around Blackpool, and I've been there myself a number of times on cases, and you see it present in the streets. It's quite sad to see.
It
yet
is.
We put the most vulnerable into those areas.
See, somebody sat down in Department of Home Office of Children's Service and said, look, Blackpool has got lots of bed and breakfasts. There are, most of them, because of COVID and other reasons, they've not been able to make any money. And so let's stick child A from, I don't know, Canterbury or somewhere in Blackpool. Instead of £500 a week, it's now costing us £50 a week or £100 a week. And that's it. And that and it's no longer a problem for the Southeast. Yeah. Hooray, Southeast, yeah. We're all safe and secure. In the Northwest, as you've just said, the poverty, the deprivation, the drug-related crime and drug, you know, just drug-related behavior, the predators, what do you think they are thinking right now? Yeah. They are now booking their holidays to Blackpool, you know? On their bus on their way, you know, paedophiles are on their way, you know? I hate to say that. This is the reality. Let's talk openly about these issues. You know, we can't do it this way, and they constantly do it this way without thinking about the consequences. And these victims are merely left behind, completely and utterly ignored, yeah. allowed to be re-victimized and re-traumatized and not properly supported. And
we'll just become another.
All I know is that it's just, I don't know, well, it's a symptom of how we put money before people.
Well, they just become another statistic, don't they? I mean, Blackpool itself has got its own epidemic in terms of being the highest proportion of its own children in care. So yes. What does that tell you? So if it has its yeah. own children in care be the highest amount, why on earth are you then putting children from other areas into that? You know, it's an epicenter now of yeah. children's homes.
And the local authority, you know, they are in a no-win situation because they would have been told by, I don't know, Kent Social Services or something, or Essex, we'll give you some money, you know.
Yes.
And so from their perspective, it's a way of plugging their own budgetary gaps, but it's treating a child as a commodity, you know, nothing more than a commodity, something you can move and simply place somewhere else rather than everything else that needs to be around that.
That's the sad reality of the existence that we have now, is that a child is a commodity. A child has a commercial value, and the large majority of children's homes in Blackpool are privately owned. So yeah. what you have is you have private owners of children's homes benefiting financially through the suffering of children. So the more children they have in their children's homes,
and link that, Mark, to another issue, that Ofsted don't have the resources to regulate children's homes. You know, Ofsted is meant to be, you know, visiting them, checking on them, et cetera, et cetera. And given the enormous number, and some of them are so small, they just don't have the resources to do so. So they're not being regulated. They're being allowed to run the way they want to run. Children are simply being treated as commodity. It's all about money. Predators know exactly where these children are. We're just creating a problem for the future, never mind for now.
And actually, it gets worse than that, because I go back to my policing days, and I remember in Surrey we had a number of children's homes where obviously children would run away, but we had a very good relationship with them. And they would obviously take in a lot of children. But because the children home numbers have diminished considerably, what you've now got is you've got the most vulnerable children who end up in children's homes. So whereas before, there were a greater spectrum of children, perhaps some of those that just needed some kind of respite care from their parents yeah. or whatever it was. Now it's the most serious, the most vulnerable. And therefore, we are putting the most vulnerable people into an area of deprivation where it has poverty, where it has huge drug abuse. And nobody is turning around and going, this is a major problem. I mean, I have to say, why is it that the likes of the NSPCC, the likes of the Children's Commissioner, the likes of the Children's Minister are not saying and up in arms and saying, come on, we've got to start treating our children better. We've got to start protecting our children.
I'm sure they probably are. I have no doubt that they're screaming and shouting. But
well, I don't hear them screaming and shouting.
Today's report will be tomorrow's chip paper. It'll be completely, yeah. utterly forgotten. The children will be forgotten. So, you've got, as you said, we've got the most vulnerable children in the most vulnerable places, without any level of support, surrounded by other children who are really, really vulnerable, in crime-ridden, with drugs all around them, and predators marking them out, and not enough police to be able to deal with it. It's the perfect storm. So, you know, all this talk we've had around Rochdale and Rotherham and Telford and all these places, mark my words, Blackpool will be on that list if it isn't already.
I want to come back to Telford very shortly, but just before we do that, this week we've heard of Marcus Mumford, obviously very well-known singer, Marcus Mumford, who has in his new song included lyrics which have now revealed that 30 years ago he was sexually abused as a child. One of those lyrics includes, and I'll read it, but I think it just sets out the tone. "I can still taste you and I hate it. That wasn't a choice in my mind of a child and you knew it." So, and the point I kind of want to really just explore slightly is that we've done it many, many times, but I think it's a point always vital to make, is that for many people, being abused as a child, it takes decades for it finally to come out, to be in a position where you finally have the confidence. Now, that sometimes that's to do with it, with your current environment, that's to deal with the fact that you're in a space that you can do that. And of course, society now is far more accepting. The likes of, you know, the work that you've done, the work that I've done around Savile, you know, has created a change in attitude. But there are still those people out there who struggle to understand why children don't talk at the time or soon after.
Well, blame them for not talking at the time. It's that victim blaming thing. I think Nicky Campbell as well revealed that he'd been abused, not, I don't think sexually abused, but he was abused too when he was at school years and years ago. And I think the report that was produced by the Office for National Statistics year before last said that at least 3.1 million British adults were sexually abused as children. That is one in 20 of us. You know, thankfully I wasn't, but you know, one in 20. So every workplace, every college, every school, everywhere where people congregate, you will have somebody who has been sexually abused as a child, and it takes immense bravery to speak up, even if it takes three decades or more. But you know, we need to change the landscape so that people, particularly young people, when they are being abused or maybe potentially being abused, are able to seek help straight away so the abuse doesn't happen, you know, never mind having to deal with the consequences after it happens. We've lost a lot of momentum on this, Mark. For, you know, the early parts of the last decades, we made enormous progress, multi-agency working, better understanding, better guidelines, understanding that, you know, decades do pass sometimes when people report, when people suffer abuse. But we've lost a lot of momentum, and I hate to say this, but we need more people like Marcus and Nikki and others who have perhaps never been able to speak about this subject to do so, because we need to get the momentum back to recognize that it's a problem not just for individuals or for celebrities, it's a problem for all of us and everywhere. And do much more work in the preventative sphere. Yeah. I don't want future Marcuses or Nicks or whatever it is. I want people to have not suffered at all.
Absolutely. So let's move on to something which I found very, very upsetting. So the Telford Child Abuse Inquiry, the report has been released in relation to that. And let me just read some of the elements of the author's verdict. So the author's verdict of that report is incredibly damning, concluding that generations of children, thousands of children, have been subjected to unnecessary suffering because of the abject failures of West Mercia Police. Echoing conclusions drawn by the investigations into similar scandals in Rotherham, Rochdale and Oxford, the report laid bare the scale of systemic failures, highlighting how many perpetrators, predominantly Asian men, were not investigated because of nervousness about appearing racist. Much of the inquiry focused on gang-related cases, but many were perpetrated by individual men.
Yes, well, I would say it's nothing. Sadly, it's nothing new, and that doesn't mean, I'm afraid, that we should just simply say, "Oh well, here we go again." No, this is ought to be a wake-up call to institutions that you have failed, and therefore you need. Don't ever tell me that lessons have been learned. No. Right, I'm going to literally throttle you if you say that, because that's not that react.
Well, they're not being learned, aren't they? You know, go back
to the experience of anybody.
Go back to Maria Caldwell in the 1970s. You know, children are still dying.
Lessons are never learned. We always need to contextualize. You know, 2/3 of all sexual abuse of children happens in the family. Second largest group of victims happen online. The third largest group happen in institutions like the BBC, places of worship, sports clubs, etc. But this issue of street grooming is alive and a real issue. And there are thousands of victims, as we've discovered, not just in Telford and other parts of the country. So what are you going to do about it? Well, you need to firstly acknowledge your failures, and that I think has been done, although I'm not sure. I think, like with most inquiries, they hope the report's been published. Let's forget it ever happened. No. You need to acknowledge your failures. You need to hold people to account for their failure. So if people didn't do their job properly, which is evident from the report, they need to be held responsible for that and account for that in some way, or apologize at the very least, but more, depending on their responsibility. And then there are still perpetrators out there, so there needs to be work with the police to ensure that the perpetrators are brought to justice. There are still hundreds of victims who have never really been listened to and heard, so they need to be given an opportunity to give their accounts and do so in a setting which enables criminal justice to get involved. There needs to be, I think one of the recommendations, as it always is better training. Well, what can I say about that? I'll say this about this. What's wrong with the current training? Have you looked at what was wrong with that and then see if that needs fixing? And better training, I'm afraid, opens the doors to all these private providers that turn up wanting a bit of Telford's money in order to deliver a training course which they've written on the back of a fag packet, The best training courses I've ever been part of and experienced are run by survivors and victims. And there will be people in Telford who've suffered, who've experienced what's happened, who've now support others. They're the people that should be engaging with to be able to educate their staff and colleagues so that they know better how to handle these things. And then there's a conversation with the communities, because clearly in this particular scenario, as in some others, British Pakistani men or British Asian men are many of the perpetrators. And therefore, what conversation is being had with the communities to firstly reassure, this is a small minority of people who offend, but at the same time, what did you know, and why do you not feel able to say anything about this particular individual who may have been involved in criminal behavior, and what could we do to educate men? Because the one thing that virtually every abuser of sexual abuse of children is their men. What can we do to educate men to recognize their responsibilities to tackle the misogyny and everything else that drives these types of behavior? So there's a number of strategies. My hope is that this report will be a lever for change. My expectation, unfortunately, is that this report will end up in a filing cabinet. That's simply because that's been my experience of so many others like it.
So one of the massive concerns that I have, and we've heard this before with other reports, is where social workers and police have written off child exploitation as child prostitution. Let's be very clear. Child prostitution doesn't exist. It is child
exploitation. It hasn't existed in the 19th century.
For somebody to even consider that, these are professionals working in the area of child sexual exploitation. Yeah. I am aghast and I am furious that people even use that terminology, child prostitution, and even think that it's something...
Also government language until... They didn't maybe use the word prostitution, but they talked about informed choice. They said, members of the public or police, prosecutors, whoever it is, remember, this is only 20 years ago. Remember that not every child is abused. Some of them have actually made an informed choice about their lifestyles, which... Well, there's a legal phrase for that, and that's bollocks. I mean, there's no getting away from it. No child can make an informed choice to be abused. And
let's be fair, there's no such thing as a child prostitute. They are child
victims. Not in the slightest. Never has been and never will be. And they really need to get their act together and as I say, recognize their faults, which have been many, put them right, and tell people what they're doing differently. Because...
And held to be account. I'm fed up. I'm literally fed up of those people who take on these responsible roles and are never held to account. There's this position where often social workers or police, officers from a senior point will turn around and say, yeah, but we can't, if we criticise or we bring action against those workers, then it will cause individuals to not come to the job. I'm sorry. If you fail, if you make a mistake in that role, and it's not just a human error. If you deliberately do that or you take a course of action which is against the whole training in the process, you need to be disciplined. And I want to start seeing those people being held to account. Children are suffering, and we see so many reports over and over and over again. And as you say, they're forgotten, because nobody ever gets held to account.
No, I mean, I can't remember the last time anybody was sacked this type of behavior, this type of failure. I can't even remember anybody that's been reported for further training they hope that it just goes away. And that's why it's absolutely essential that we keep it on our radar and keep it on the radar of everybody that might be able to do something about it, so that people should be held to account. We need, every 3 months they need to be reporting, Telford Borough Council or City Council, need to be reporting what they have done as a result of this report. And so people can hold them to the fire, in effect, for their actions, rather than simply brush them under the carpet as if it's yesterday's news.
Yeah. So we're here, we talk about crime already, but I do think there's one other area which I think is so important, and I think we should just briefly touch on it. And that is the cost of living. The cost of living now, electricity bills and so on, it's quite scary, isn't it, that there are people out there who are not going to be able to cope.
I'm very fortunate I'm not as poor as I ought to be as a public servant, but anyway, but it is devastating, and I don't think anybody really has understood it. Certainly, politicians haven't grasped it in the same way that they may have grasped COVID, for example, that this is a national, if not international, emergency. It is an emergency. People just cannot afford basics. And in October, when the energy prices go up again, and they go up again in January, people who have struggled to pay £100 a month for energy will be paying £1,000 a month. Well, they won't, because they just don't have it. And I've seen Martin Lewis. Martin gets angry quite a bit, but right now I worry for him. His blood pressure is going through the roof because he's. He's on top of the data and everything, and can point to this. We are in an absolute devastating situation, and this is why. And it is a national emergency, and yet what we're getting is nothing. No. The Prime Minister's off, and already gone off. Literally, and nobody else wants to take responsibility for it. Nobody. It's not our problem, and of course. What it's also shining a light on is the enormous profits being made by the energy companies, particularly.
Yes, huge.
Whereas we can barely rub two pennies together. They are rubbing billions of pounds together per quarter, and it's leading to a very, very fragile situation. Now, I've never said this publicly. Maybe I should. I am concerned that it will lead to disorder. I am concerned that people are getting so angry and are suffering so much that we may get to the level of public disorder. And I'm pretty sure the Home Office and others are aware of this, and police particularly are keeping an eye on intelligence and all the rest of it. We've been here before, those of us old enough to remember. And it doesn't take a lot for, particularly with the heat, it doesn't take a lot for a fire to start, does it? And before we know it, we're dealing with riots and all the rest of it, and that, to my mind, should be at the forefront of our mind. But the most important thing that should be forefront of our mind is that people are suffering. I ran into a primary school teacher at an event a couple of weeks ago, and she told me she's relatively new in primary school in teaching, and she said that she almost broke down telling me this. She said that she had to go to a food bank recently. And at the food bank, she ran into the parent of one of the children that she teaches. And I didn't quite know how to respond to that. She's given, she's educated, professionalized, studied, and taken on this job, which is the most difficult job in the world and the most important job in the world, educating our young. And yet she now has to resort to a food bank to feed herself. And she was embarrassed. Not just by the fact that she was having to do that, but that she ran into the parent of one of the teachers, one of the pupils she teaches, and that even made it even more embarrassing, for her, and more shameful for her. And all I know, Mark, is that it's only going to get worse unless somebody grasps it, and by somebody I mean the government.
Yes. That's all for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Let's remind everybody, 10th of September, we're both at CrimeCon. We're doing
Live
Fear or Favour. please do come along. There are still some tickets available, I understand. And then you can join in, and certainly we'd love to see you there. So Nazir, for another week, thank you so much.
Appreciate please, it. All the very best.
Please do continue to send us your emails, your thoughts in terms of Fear or Favour, and subscribe via our website. Please do continue to listen, look after yourself, and we'll see you in 2 weeks' time. Take care.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast. Do please tell your true crime friends, and it's important that you subscribe to our channel. If you've got any thoughts or you just simply want to get in touch, you can do so via our Twitter page, Fear or Favour, or go to our website, www.fearorfavour.com. The series is edited by Martin Kays, the music by Dylan Epega. Fear or Favour is an original true crime podcast in association with Audioboom.